Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Kostura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of July 20th, 2026. All right, Tom, what do you got for us?
All right, kicking it off this week, I have an article from Group IB. It's titled Holograph, Turning Microsoft 365 Calendars into Covert Command and Control Channels. So Group IB uncovered Holograph, which is a new Windows malware family attributed with high confidence to the Cavern espionage framework that was previously associated with Iranian Nexus operations. Rather than using attacker-owned infrastructure, Holograph abuses Microsoft 365 and Microsoft Graph API to hide command and control communications within legitimate enterprise cloud traffic. The malware transforms a compromised Microsoft 365 mailbox calendar into a two-way dead drop. Operators place encrypted commands inside future dated calendar events, while the implant exfiltrates stolen files by creating its own calendar events with encrypted attachments. One of the report's really most interesting findings is the use of DNS tunneling as a secondary communication channel. Instead of using DNS for normal C2, Holograph retrieves updated Microsoft Entra ID credentials through specially crafted IPv6 quad A DNS responses, really allowing the malware to refresh authentication of Microsoft Graph without hard-coded secrets. The campaign demonstrates how espionage operators really kind of continue shifting their thinking, how they can leverage, blend in, and adapt with the various SaaS platforms that are out now, and really kind of, in this case, appearing almost indistinguishable from normal Microsoft 365 traffic. So some of the technical highlights of this specific article, again, mentioning that Holograph does communicate exclusively through Microsoft Graph API. The malware authenticates to a compromised 365 tenant and then interacts with a mailbox calendar rather than attacker-controlled servers, causing that network to blend in really well. It leverages a calendar-based dead drop, so they create a calendar event containing encrypted tasking. The malware will periodically retrieve calendar events and download encrypted attachments. And then for Exfil, Holograph creates new calendar events and uploads that encrypted stolen files as attachments. So it really only supports two core commands, which is a get and a send. One of the interesting pieces here is that each of the malicious calendar events that are created are dated well into the future. In this specific instance, in the from the reporting here, it was when the calendar events were created, they were created for May 13th of 2050, so well out into the future. This, to me, also, without having some hyper-specifics on the logs, because this is something I still want to kind of chase down and understand myself, Scott, but I would imagine this would help to provide higher fidelity signal by tracking those kind of events set into the future type anomalies. So the encrypted communication side, separate RSA key pairs protect inbound and outbound communications. The payloads are additionally encrypted using AES-256, ensuring that even administrators inspecting the calendar attachments can't easily recover the command content that was baked within them. And then we have the DNS tunneling for that credential refresh. So pretty interesting here that a whole separate communication channel is set up to use DNS. It issues a specially crafted quad A IPv6 DNS queries, and the returned IPv6 records encode Microsoft Entra tenant ID, the client ID, client secret, and the target mailbox. These refresh credentials are written into a local configuration file. In this case, they were dubbed logazure.txt and used for subsequent Graph API authentications. So there was also a mention of native AOT implementation. So Holograph is compiled as a .NET native AOT DLL. Native AOT removes much of that .NET metadata typically used during reverse engineering, making static analysis considerably more difficult than looking at traditional .NET malware. And then that connection that I had mentioned to the Cavern framework. So they do have an association to the broader cavern espionage framework. And then they Group IV had mentioned, rather than replacing cavern, Holograph functions as more of a specialized communications plugin focused specifically at that Microsoft 365 based command and control, what it's trying to do. So I really thought this was kind of interesting, Scott. I like seeing some stuff. You know, we don't get to talk a whole ton about like cloud side things. So I was excited to see and read this one. Some stuff that I kind of pulled out of it, although I do need to chase it down because I do have some ignorance and gaps, and maybe you can fill in some of this. We kind of started talking about it a little bit before the show. There is telemetry for the Microsoft Graph usage, the API usage. However, it's not on by default, something you have to switch on. And then from there, a couple of the signals that I kind of mentioned, like it's leveraging Graph API to create, read, and write to these calendar events. So you can track those calendar.read API calls, the calendar.read/write API calls, the calendar event creation, and also the attachments are associated with it. This is based on my preliminary research chasing this down from a hunter's perspective. Definitely a signal piece there. They also talk about the DNS side. So I was trying to think about what are possible things we can do from that side. Some bullets that I had, Scott, and please poke holes in these because, again, preliminary. Looking at kind of like the repeated quad A DNS queries, looking for unusually long IPv6 responses perhaps might be a good traction for signal, and a few other things. So this is kind of like outside of our normal hunting scope because it sits more in this specific area, but it is really interesting. And I'm already excited to kind of chase down how I might be able to go after this, but some of the behavior, some of the things we're seeing, a little bit novel, a little bit newer, and just thought it was interesting. Scott, what's your take?
Yeah. So I think this is interesting because I don't know how far back, but it was definitely a little earlier this year, but we talked about Cavern as this kind of a post exploitation framework. And it was, when we talked about it, it was very modular then, and it covered down on a lot of the common techniques that we've seen. And you can kind of tell by having a kind of a modular framework and continuous development, this is clearly a capability that wasn't really seen in the first kind of review of Cavern, and probably has since been developed. So as far as how the code is distributed with the .NET, mixture of like .NET, C++ style compiling, that is consistent as far as it goes, but the capabilities obviously are changing. And I think it's an interesting use from an attack perspective. Obviously, there's been people that have used like Gmail and stuff to try to like share things via drafts for command and control or, move sensitive information. And so all these kind of like office suite are you can be kind of creative with how to leverage them. I even think C2's been done with like Google's Sheets and stuff like that as well. But yeah, in this case, because they're using a graph to do the communication, you'll obviously see the actions within the graph log data. But I'm assuming you'll see the same kind of data from the O365 logs as well, which they don't really hit on here, but maybe because they're leveraging Graph as like the mechanism to make these changes, that's where they kind of focus initially. But the thing about stuff in Graph data, usually just because there's an action there, there's no guarantee like it was successful. Someone makes a post, someone makes a get, someone does whatever with the Graph API, and there's no like you see the success or failure response to that. So it's a good indication, but it's kind of good to have some other data to either validate, or maybe there's even more enriched or valuable data that you can leverage because it's the graph data can be very verbose as far as just any kind of action being kind of documented. The DNS tunneling piece, it's also interesting because they kind of have a hard coded DNS server that it's reaching out to directly. So it's always really good to control your DNS internally, even if like someone you're not like managing an actual DNS server, but kind of know where things are going for as far as configured DNS, whether you like pointed at Google or some other main DNS provider, and then have some way to have visibility to DNS requests in general. Because one, I think it's kind of odd to see the Quad A IPv6 calls. I know it's more popular, but it's only more popular with like bigger, like a Microsoft resource and stuff like that, as far as companies go. But seeing Quad A requests in general, obviously, I think Quad A is used here because you can actually fit more data in a Quad A record versus the single A or whatever it is. So that's why it's probably being leveraged. But knowing that you have DNS going to kind of a rogue DNS server that you haven't seen before, if you can see that telemetry, that's great. As well as seeing the Quad A might also potentially throw some red flags, depending on where it's going, right? It's just something else to kind of add to. A lot of things are still using kind of just standard A records for IPv4. So those are some key pieces there. Definitely worth paying attention to. The whole planning things in the future, you know, it's an interesting approach just because obviously no one's going to see that on their calendar. So you can interact with someone's like space without their awareness. And depending on if they're getting valid credentials for this, or, you know, there's a potential where an app can, you know, how you can authorize app access when you, I forgot exactly what it's called, but there's like an app ID typically associated with it, and permissions get assigned to different apps that you kind of allow things. It might be worth paying attention to. I don't know if they specifically use an app in this case, but, you know, if you have apps that are registered in your environment to users, look for the right calendar request stuff. See which apps can do that. That might be another indication of maybe the similar behavior potentially being leveraged, not necessarily this attack. But if this is something that's kind of on the radar and successful and people don't really get in the way of it, it, you know, could grow into a more common technique that other people try to adopt as well. So understanding the different ways people can kind of manipulate things, and where you see them is also really beneficial. But yeah, it's just a really cool piece as far as a level of sophistication and working with the tools that you have to facilitate their requirements.
Well said, man. What do you got next for us, Scott?
So yeah, the next one I thought was fascinating. There's kind of a lot there if you were to dig into the actual research, but it's something I just picked up on the Hacker News. I kind of hit a lot of the Hacker News stuff this week, but it was titled "The New Bit2Watt Attack Could Let Cloud Tenants Disrupt Power Grids Without an Exploit." And basically there was research done that, you know, with the whole AI and the builds for large farms of GPUs and things, GPUs, anytime you're going to leverage, I mean, CPUs are the same, except for GPUs can pull the hell of a lot more power. They're like the hungry puppy, right? You give them something to do and they just like, all right, let's go do it. There's not like a throttling necessarily. It's like, let's get it done. So they can go from like 0 to 100, you know, instantly. And you have people farm of these things that can pull considerable amount of power. That's a huge energy pool. And so what they basically did with the research was said, this could be a potential vulnerability to the grid, because if people are able to control that surge, and that demand that's going to basically impact the grid around it, and then drop the surge spontaneously and then hit the surge. I mean, it's almost kind of like the whole Stuxnet with like spinning the centrifuge, right? Where you can kind of get it to wobble by constantly doing a spin up, a spin down, a spin up to create instability. Same idea with the power grid. The power grid is kind of a living thing. So you're able to create these surges and drops. And with generation, they have to accommodate for, oh, there needs to be power. Maybe we spin up more generation. Oh, now there's no demand for power. We cut generation. And especially if there is potentially legacy or old equipment, that kind of strain could also be an impact as well. So they were just kind of doing the research on basically what this could look like. They ran through a bunch of different scenarios with different types of GPUs, And, you know, one of the things was that they were basically causing the surge with was like doing training iterations, right? So they would kick off a whole training set, which is very demanding when it comes to like some of the sustained AI utilization when it's not training is not usually as high as actual training. And so it just kind of, and, you know, one of the vulnerabilities that is already being assessed today is the demand of data centers and how there might not be sufficient power to just actually add these data centers. Now you add the surging capability on top of it. That could be doubly impactful with that. And so I think this attack is interesting because it's a way to attack something without attacking it, right? And I remember even talking to someone who is a professional that their job was to look at vulnerabilities and control systems and things like that. And they were tasked of doing basically kind of like a pen test, right? Of an energy target. And this similar approach, they didn't know how to really get in because everything's so isolated from a network perspective. But at the time, there's really bad storms in the area. And they had flooding in like one of the substation buildings. And so one of the band-aids that they had to do to address the flooding, so they didn't have all this water surging up towards equipment that could cause the problems. They put a webcam in to monitor and a sump pump, right? That I don't know if they control the sump pump remotely or not. But this person building an attack looked at the same thing like, oh, if I can prevent them from engaging the sump pump or make them think the water level isn't high so they engage the sump pump, I can create the effect I'm looking for without actually attacking my intended target directly. And so, you know, us that work in this space, I think it kind of highlights that sometimes we might be hyper-focused on, I need to have hands on the thing that I need to protect. And the only way it'll be attacked is if someone can put their hands on it too. And I think this is almost an exercise of like the disaster recovery exercise stuff, where if something happens, like what do you do when you completely lose this, right? Because that creates that out of the box thinking a little more. But it's just a good example that some of the threats we deal with might be environmental, might be situational. And there's many ways where adversaries, if they're intelligent enough, they can easily take advantage of that. And at the lowbrow, at the minimum of that, you think of just like the standard phishing, social engineering that happens like a tax season or Valentine's Day, you know, that kind of stuff. They're taking advantage of something else too, right? Same idea. But in this case, this was a pretty interesting attack for something that can have much greater impacts to a lot more people and potentially, you know, countries at large. So interesting research, kind of adds a little bit of fear factor, but I think it's relevant. And I think it's solvable too, because you just put controls in place, right? And hopefully you protect those controls. But cool write-up. The research paper is really involved. They really go into a lot of like the underlying details and the calculations and things that they did. So if you like that stuff, you can definitely find that the paper as well and read through it. But yeah, what was your thoughts? Just kind of being aware of this type of attack and that kind of thought process behind it.
I'll stop short of saying it's the things of nightmares a little bit. You know, with the you know, the movements and the data center talk all over, the support infrastructure for the growing technology sector, AI and all the things within it. I'm just happy that this research is being done, quite honestly. It's super interesting. It's something that I know, at least from our perspective, like in our field, we're not really considering this per se, but it's absolutely something we need to be aware of too. I don't know, man. I thought this was really interesting. One of the ones that I was trying to unravel in my mind is where they had an association with the with Power Hammer, where it talks about the modulation doubles as a covert channel. Encoding bits is two frequencies, 2 kilohertz for one, 200 hertz for a zero. The team had captured the electromagnetic emissions on a near field antenna wired to a software defined radio, and they were able to recover a 50 bit test sequence with no errors. That was pretty interesting.
what it entirely means, or is it entirely useful at this point as far as we're concerned? No, but it's absolutely interesting and intriguing. But yeah, this is neat, man.
Well, you know, just as an anecdote, I've actually impacted myself with this at a smaller scale because, you know, I sit with a lot of equipment on a single breaker and I play with some AI stuff and I run some GPUs, right? And there's been plenty of times where I'm like, I got too many things on. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, let me kick off this thing and see what happens. And they get that surge of power and boom, breaker blows. Right. And the only thing that stays on it, things backed up by UPS. It's the same kind of impact. Obviously my breaker and my breaker panel is not as resilient as the grid. But you know, it's interesting to see that I don't even have like time to respond to the surge. And I even have, or, you know, I even have like, yeah, I have like battery backups on things that will keep other things alive, but it doesn't necessarily protect the surge either. So, interesting.
My hope is that research like this will generate more consideration for things to support that gap, right? Like being able to actually detect anomalies faster, react faster, leverage things like batteries and stuff to help, you know, mitigate the incident kind of thing. But crossing fingers.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So. Yeah, what do you got next?
All right. Next one I have today is from Elastic Security. It's titled Contagious Interview. SVG Steganography Delivers Multi-Stage Malware. So Elastic Security Labs uncovered a new contagious interview campaign targeting software developers through fake job opportunities and realistic coding challenges. The researchers themselves were targeted after a malicious recruiter posted a job in Elastic's public Slack workspace. Rather than hiding malware in JavaScript or npm install scripts, the attackers concealed the payload inside a SVG flag image using HTML comment-based steganography. The campaign ultimately delivers a four-stage malware framework aligned with Otter Cookie, consisting of a browser credential and cryptocurrency wallet stealer, file stealer, socket.io-based rat, and a clipboard stealer. At the time of Elastic's publication, none of the recovered repositories were detected by antivirus engines. The research highlights a continuing shift in the DTRK's tradecraft. This is one of the takes that I definitely took away from this. Rather than exploiting software vulnerabilities, the attackers compromised that developer trust by weaponizing normal coding exercises, typical repository use and development workflows. So some of the technical sides for this one. So victims would receive recruiter outreach via Slack or other platforms, and then they're directed to clone what appears to be a legitimate Next.js e-commerce application. The application functions normally, reducing suspicion while also executing malicious logic in the background, because of course it does. The steganography side, the payload is fragmented into Base64 chunks. Rather than embedding the payload in those JavaScript files, the fragments are hidden inside HTML comment blocks within the SVG flag images. Traditional AV engines typically inspect executable content rather than the SVG comment fields, which really makes this kind of fly under the radar. The payload side, a malicious script, here it's servervalidation.js. It will enumerate that SVG file. The Base64 fragments are then collected alphabetically, and the fragments are concatenated, decoded, reconstructed into JavaScript and executed with the eval function. Execution occurs when a local development server starts npm run dev, not simply by viewing the SVG. So just the breakout of the four stages. So stage one, the loader will reconstruct and execute the hidden payload. Stage two, the browser credential and cryptocurrency wallet stealer happens. Stage three is where we see the file stealer targeting document source code and other artifacts from the developer side. And then stage four is where that socket.io based rat supporting, remote command execution, clipboard theft, and other module loading. That's where that occurs. So Otter Cookie searches and looks for, again, those browser and crypto side items, SSH keys, cloud credentials, source code, ENV files, and other artifacts that it defines. Malware will then upload the collected data using HTTP form data requests to the attacker infrastructure. So also of note, heavy obfuscation used here. Elastic observed significantly more obfuscation than previous Otter Cookie variants, including encoded string pulls, shuffled arrays, indirect index lookups, and various runtime decoding methods. Those changes really reduce useful static analysis of this while preserving the full functionality. So there's this one. It's very interesting. I'm natively now really drawn to stuff that's leveraging or going after the developers because of all of the supply chain workspace. And while this one isn't distinctively targeting supply chain in that way, I think the fallout and execution from things it does collect will lead to that based on what we kind of know and how the DPRK has gotten involved in some of this supply chain fiasco and leveraging the behaviors and things like that. A lot of stuff that we typically care about here. So again, Node, it does come into play. While it's not a simple direct use of Node, to correlate that connection with the npm run dev and the node.js execution, looking at outbound connections from that process path or that tree, and then seeing all the different stealer methodologies, right? So like going after your browser credential stuff, searching for your ENV files, all of the stuff that we've talked about for stealers in general, really kind of my biggest takeaways here. Scott, I'll take a breath, man. What'd you think of this one?
Now, I mean, it's always interesting when you see steganography involved, and then, it's a great piece where, hey, we can just write a basic program that from like a, hey, you're looking for higher type aspects and here's the job or the tests, write something, and then they just include malicious code. So it doesn't really matter if they get the job, they already get the job done. Or what they're trying to do. So it's kind of an interesting approach, but we've seen a lot of that, how to get your foot in the door through job requests and things like that from North Korea. So they're probably just going to continue to specialize more and more and find other potential ways to do all this. But from a technical perspective, I mean, there's a lot of things that stand out as potentially identifiable from a easy to understand perspective once things are running. And that is, you have where things are actually running from. Hold on, I'm looking at the wrong piece there. Yeah, the paying attention to the script interpreter chaining, I was going to get to that, but I'll start with that. Why? Find the other thing I was going to say, where you see the, Node kicking off command prompt, kicking off PowerShell from the Windows side perspective. There's also the discovery of things using WMIC to try to get local information. Which is, kind of stands out. And then with the different operating systems, there's different things that are read. Obviously, it can execute the system profiler. But with the Linux side, it's a little tougher because they're reading, because Linux, the way the operating system, I guess Mac's somewhat similar, but it is like a file-based operating system where everything that's, live is also a file. So they get the information from there, they actually read the file versus running something. So you won't see so much of an execution from that discovery perspective. Worth paying attention to note. But the other thing is the clipboard access on the Windows side. I feel like that was the most obvious thing because it basically kicks off PowerShell and runs the git clipboard commandlet every 500 milliseconds. So that'd be like twice a second you would see PowerShell spawning. And I feel like just from an execution thing, if you just looked at like of over abuse or overuse of PowerShell and you saw like hundreds of instances of PowerShell spawn within a very, very short window of time, that would be alarming to me if I looked at the data or grouped the data that way. So that was a pretty telling component. But obviously things are already running and things are probably already collected at that point. You'll just be able to identify that this occurred and respond, after the fact, because it's obviously he's trying to steal credentials and steal that kind of information. So if you at least are able to identify the attack, you can go through your, okay, well, what kind of keys or credentials did this potentially get access to? And once you clear that up and roll those, the risks for the most part is greatly reduced. So So yeah, just kind of a creative approach. Stego is always kind of an interesting thing to be included as far as assembly goes, but some of the after actions on target kind of thing, I would say nothing hugely novel there. So yeah,
nope, not at all. I thought too, the one thing that was interesting that might be signaled, although I don't know, I can't really think off the top of my head how extremely common it would be to see a like a text file be converted or like renamed to an EXE. So that was something that kind of stood out. Plus the curl usage, like there's a lot of like, you know, low hanging fruit signals here that are pretty easy to pick up on. But yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what's last this week, Scott? What you got?
So this one was just kind of interesting. It's a island.io blog. And it's titled Agent Baiting, How 800 Plus Fake AI Skills and MCP Servers Delivered Malware. So previously, this was kind of a technique to drop, I believe, the same smart loader malware earlier this year. But it was more targeting where you just people would download MCP servers to use, and it was already kind of embedded in. That's kind of how they got hit, but it was like a user driven thing. Well, now, because we, you know, a lot of AI workflows have worked towards agents. Apparently when you're using an agent to say, hey, I need this new skill or an MCP server for X, you know, these agents will go look at the libraries and repos and find what makes the most sense and, pull those in. So essentially attackers have done similar things. Like we've seen from a lot of like the supply chain, NPM and Python repo problems. They'll create clones of legitimate repos that look almost identical, change names slightly, include whatever the smart loader malware that they basically have. And in this case, the smart loader was loading SteelC for information stealing as the, like kind of the second chain of that. And it was just an interesting article because it was like the social engineering aspect. Some people feel more secure when they're like, well, if a computer does it, how would it be socially engineered? Because you can't manipulate emotions and things. But it's going to search for things the same way we would. And the only difference is unless it's like told to really scrutinize or double check or do all these types of things, there's a good chance it will just fall on this. And I believe when they did their tests, they tested multiple models to see and ask for specific skills and things. And they were able to see in the research just like how often it happened and what they would land on. And it seemed like it was pretty successful. And they're even talking, and this is Git specifically. GitHub creation is where these repos or skills exist. And they even mapped based on the fake Git campaign repository growth. How that's greatly increasing in general. And the AI themed ones are also growing on top of that. Probably similar targeting, right? And so it was just an interesting approach. And the one key thing that is kind of worth noting is the persistence piece. There was persistence in scheduled tasks. That's the app data directory. So things pointing to that for the smart loader piece. That was the only technical piece they got into. And I know we've probably talked about SteelC, but you know, there's something SteelC does as well. And I believe it does a registry run key, like a lot of the info stealers that run. But yeah, it's just another interesting way to kind of social engineer devs, which seemed like a really big target. I guess everyone's a dev now. I should like not really make them their own class because everybody now can write their own things, or at least thinks they can. But yeah, so using social engineering like techniques to target agents with no human in the loop to basically get compromised, and then the human loses their credentials. So pretty interesting research, worth noting, because of our world and day to day and some of the supply chain attack stuff in general. I feel like it's kind of another, edge case. So, hey, what are your thoughts?
One of the takeaways I had from this one was the consideration of leveraging your existing AI tooling in the prompting through it. So they talk at length in here about what they apply the name to. They call it agent baiting. Mm-hmm. Your AI agent is kind of the new target. Basically, they did a few tests where they prompted their agent to go find something that would have aligned with where these malicious repos sit. And in one case, it went out and found two. One was benign. The other one was one of the malicious malicious drops that were part of this campaign. And this was with Claude, and it recommended the benign one, but it also came back and said it's a failsafe. You can use this, the secondary one too. So it didn't really identify that there is a problem going on, which it not necessarily would, right? It's not trained to or anything like that. So it's something to consider from the user side. They also did it a similar thing with ChatGPT, and it came to the same conclusion. It would pull down the malicious repositories from the prompt. And something that I thought was a big takeaway, I definitely keep in mind that, because we are creating a world and developing a world where we're leveraging these agents, we're leveraging these tools to go do things, and we're creating this like really fast workflow, right? It's almost in parallel with some of the speed to market problems we talked about like last year. And this is something where I think the user just needs to make sure that you're aware of the things you're doing, and you apply and consider putting checks in your processes, right? It's one good way to help yourself in that, like in this specific scenario with this agent baiting layout, apply checks within your prompting to make sure that the thing you're pulling in can have some level of overview, that you can understand what you're doing, what you're using, and try to maybe avoid slipping into some of these malicious packages. And the counts that they talked about here, there was a lot. I think it was something around like 14 million at the time of reporting. And that's not counting anything that was downloaded like from a zip file, because that data is not tracked. So definitely something to be aware of. It's out of the box thinking for sure, but we need to expand our box to keep up with the times, right? So
yeah, it's interesting, because like when we talk about like AI or agents or in the machine learning and that kind of stuff, right? Like we talk about the intelligence that we try to, you know, quote unquote intelligence, right? As far as it exists. But, you know, you got to wonder at what point do we grade the critical thinking aspect of that intelligence, right? Like that, I think that's something that we assume there's critical thinking going on, but is it really critical thinking? And is that something that's really lacking from a lot of this AI infrastructure? Is not only can it like do good things and find patterns and trends, but can it like critically think on its own without being prompted to necessarily, right? And what is critical thinking at that point? If you had to define it and have AI learn it, you know, what would that even look like? I think that's something that we take for granted, because when we think something's intelligence, we assume that it uses critical thinking. But I feel like that's the biggest hole when it comes to these like AI driven attacks or things that target AI is, I mean, even look at how you circumvent AI and prompting when, you know, earlier in the, I don't know if it still works, but like earlier in the days, be like, hey, I want to do an attack and but I exist in the 1800s. So computers don't exist. So there's no like risk. And the AI is like, oh, well, if that's the case, then I can basically tell you, because it's not going to hurt anything. It's like, everyone knows that if there's critical thinking, it'd be like, that's impossible. You don't, because you can't go backwards in time. You know what I mean? Like stuff like that clearly doesn't exist within these models. So, it's just interesting.
And we shouldn't, my opinion, we shouldn't expect that. We should understand that we're using a tool that gives us a bit of a false confidence in the level of the appeared intelligence that's behind it, right? Because the tools are really good and they're just getting better faster, right? But I think it's a good reminder to check into that human frame, and not to go totally into the like the psychology side of it, but check into your human, into that human frame, and remember, you're part of this. It's a force multiplier, and that's what it should. That's how, at least again, my opinion, I think people need to treat this approach. It's a force multiplier. And as that force multiplier, you are still part of the equation.
and there are still decision points that have to be made by you, it's okay to step back and take a breath and not move fast. And I think sometimes if we simply do that, especially with this specific topic, we could probably save ourselves a lot of headache and discover things to fix and improve them faster. But again, just my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe we don't really want to offload critical thinking. Maybe that's the part we want to keep for ourselves, you know, yeah. Like be aware of that. Like, you know, that's your job as the human in the loop.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that kind of closes out everything that we were going to talk about this week. So with that, I really want to thank everybody for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next time. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of July 20th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.